Okay, well, good evening, everyone. I'm really happy to be here, even if I'm sort of vomitously nervous because, you know, it's a keynote and that means, you know, big and important things. So, yeah, this is a large crowd and probably one of the biggest crowds of people that are not, you know, solely Fedora folks that I've ever really spoken in front of. So, keep your shields up in the front row. No, I'm kidding. This is actually the first conference that I ever talked at, and that was in September of 2010, so it's nice to be back here again. When I was there that year, I gave a talk about strategy and planning in open source communities and how you didn't want to do that like a Cylon. How many of you guys have watched Battlestar Galactica? So this is like one of my favorite shows on Earth. And at the end of the opening credits, they would always say, like, and they have a plan, right? Cylons have a plan. But if you watch the show, it became very apparent over time that there was not actually a plan at all. Like, they were just fouling things up left and right. And during the course of the talk that I gave, you know, just 3 years ago, wow, 3 years, I talked about how having a plan actually helps people in your community to know if, you know, do I even want to be in this community? Where are we going? You know, what should I be doing? But at that point in time, I didn't actually have a paying job in open source like I do now. I was just a volunteer. And it certainly was not in, you know, my own plan to have the job that I do now. So, oh, no, I pressed the wrong button. There we go. Okay. So, I have a crazy job. So I am, for those of you who don't know me, I'm the Fedora project leader. I work for Daddy Shadow Man, AKA Red Hat. We commonly abbreviate the title as FPL, so if I say FPL, that's sort of what I mean. My good friend and former FPL, Max Spivak, once referred to this particular job as sort of like being a CEO. Like, you're essentially the CEO of Fedora. You're ultimately accountable for everything that's going on, except unlike a CEO at like a real company, you don't have like this magic wand of resources and, you know, a private jet and all sorts of other magical things, right? So in spite of, you know, the job titles having the word leader in it, you're not really just leading. I mean, that's certainly a big part of what you're doing, but that's not just it, right? You know, you are listening all the time. You're listening to people's ideas. You're listening to people fighting. You're reading about them fighting on mailing lists. You're, you know, listening to drama. You're dealing with, you know, I deal with things like money decisions and buying plane tickets and, you know, endless decision making and, you know, should we make a decision? Let's have a decision meeting about making a decision to make a decision. And really, you know, I seem to always have this bottomless pile of to-dos. And for me personally, some of it is just, I hate to use the word mothering, but there's certainly mothering involved. There's, you know, being friends with people, being a friend to people. It's funny, when I actually interviewed for my job at Red Hat several years ago, which was actually not long after I gave the talk 3 years ago, they asked me about my recent relevant work experience. And I'd been a stay-at-home mom for 7 years, and I was like, well, you know, let's see, recent job experience. I sort of am a janitor. I deal with people who fight all the time. I teach people stuff. I try to help these people grow up into being a little more self-sufficient, you know, teach them how to do things and be nice, you know, get along. I think that's, you know, a pretty good foundation for the job that I might be doing here, just, you know, and they're like, yeah, I don't know about that. But I do sort of believe that, you know, they have an interesting parallel to one another. But, you know, being in open source and, you know, having worked in a variety of paid and unpaid roles, you know, within an open source community, I can say that this list of stuff that we do, the listening and the caring and all of these kinds of things, is not really unique just to when you are a leader, right? Many, if not most folks who are actually embedded in or contributing to an open source community or an open source project deal with a lot of that craziness, you know, in one way or another. And in a lot of ways, it's you know, we all sometimes feel almost as though, you know, we are Atlas. We are carrying the world upon our shoulders and, you know, are we going to break down and lose it one of these days? And I think those feelings really specifically affect those people in communities who aren't just contributing to the project itself. They're not just giving code or documentation or helping out with marketing, but they're also contributing to the overall architecture of the community, right? The inner workings of the community itself. They're working with other people in the community to make the community, the way it's actually running, get better. But if you step back a bit, you know, even if you step back from the paradigm of open source, it's not just us, right? These issues are sort of common to people who are in various communities of practice. Who here has heard of the phrase or the term community of practice? Okay, so there's a great book called Communities of Practice, and I will recommend that you go out and read it, but I will give you the short Robin version of the term, and I basically define it as this. It's people with a common interest who care about how to improve what they do and what they do and how they do it by sharing best practices with others who also have common interests, right? So people who are, you know, there are people who do, I hate even saying this phrase, who do DevOps things, right? And I know that that word just makes people want to vomit right now and how people use it. But, you know, people don't just talk about, you know, I'm using this tool. They also talk about things like, you know, their best practices for, you know, how they think about problems and problem solving and how they might use Kanban in their organization, things like that. That's more of the community of practice. Like, I may work at one place, you may work at another place, but we're talking about the common things that affect us that aren't just the tools and the bits, it's the how we do things. But the common thread I find amongst people in communities of practice is this, is that they all really want to make the world a better place. You know, they're passionate, they're true believers, and, you know, these people, if you think about it, they're really everywhere, right? Teachers, firefighters, librarians, mental health care professionals, religious services people, you know, priests, rabbis, pastors, other, you know, 45 other kinds of religious people who are leaders that I couldn't name, and I'm probably just offending everyone, but I'll just move on. So none of those are really jobs that you go into, you know, for the super outstanding paychecks, right? No one hears about the teacher who's making $1 billion a year and her school district just went to IPO or anything like that. And for lots of us in open source, you know, not for me now, but certainly there was a time when the stuff you do is completely unpaid, right? Except in terms of, you know, sort of the gratification it gives you and, you know, that eventually, you know, in some way you'll be consuming it again yourself. And in all of these groups, you know, for the really true believers amongst those groups, the people who want to improve not just, you know, their end result, whatever that end result is, but, you know, they want to share how they're doing it and why they're doing it with other people who are doing similar things, you know, that really is about making the world a better place, whether it's, you know, safer or more educated or, you know, books for everyone, whatever it is, that's gonna kill me.
Books for everyone.
Thank you. Whatever it is, you know, it's about making the world a better place. You know, in Fedora, you know, our mission is to lead the advancement of free and open source software and content as a collaborative community, which is a total mouthful, right? But what we really want to do is just help to shape a world where, you know, free open source type culture, where people can share, like, we want that to be normal, right? Like, we're here at Ohio Linux Fest because, you know, we're still sort of the group of believers that this is the way of the future, but it is the way of the future, and I want that future to get here sooner. And so we all, you know, in Fedora and lots of us in the rest of our communities are working every day to make this world more free in all senses of the word. And we're continually trying to get others to, you know, work with us on spreading all of that freedom. You know, we are trying to all make the world a better place. We know that people come to open source to scratch their own itches. But even the most inspiring of people that we know in open source, the people that we might think of as leaders, even if they don't have that specific title attached to what they do, but they, you know, they're leading by example, they get attached to what they do not only on because of the itchy, scratchy thing that brought them there in the first place, but, you know, they also get attached to helping others in their community. They want to help other people succeed. They get attached to making the community actually function better. But sometimes when they're doing that, you know, and I said earlier, it can sort of feel like you're literally carrying the world upon your shoulders. I've seen, you know, inside open source, outside of open source, that, you know, there are times when people give so much of themselves and they care so much that they reach a point where they simply feel like they have nothing left to give. And they've almost lost themselves along the way, and they're not really finding any passion in what they do anymore. And that feeling has a word, and we call that burnout. No. Darn it. This is not my clicker. My clicker got borrowed by someone else, and I never saw it again. So, let me climb into my Wayback Machine here for a moment. So this is Chandler, Arizona. I first learned about this awesome thing we call burnout while living here in the early 2000s. I worked at this awesome place you've probably heard of called Intel. This was before I had kids. I worked in the embedded division. I had this really fun job where I basically got to calculate how much money we could make off of someone's crazy idea. So I had all sorts of ideas come to me like, we can make set-top boxes, and I think we could sell, you know, this many of them. And I would look at those numbers and go, yeah, that's a set-top box for every man, woman, and child on the planet times 12 in the next year. Yeah, realism, like, good idea, needs a little bit more realism, right? So, you know, I did lots of stuff with spreadsheets. Intel is very, you know, it's obviously a manufacturing company, so it's very, very process-driven. And generally, in terms of the people who work there, the people are highly driven. And it's a place where you're sort of prone to just want to or need to work all the time. And I say that, you know, Intel is a really, really cool place to work. You learn a ton of stuff. But, you know, it's also sort of daunting when you come in and they're like, the first class you're supposed to take is the work-life balance class, because they just know that these things get out of whack quite a bit with people who work there. So, yes, every day I would drive to my happy little cubicle out, you know, I live sort of, the map, not to scale, FYI. I live sort of south down the 101 here, and actually that part of the 101 wasn't even built. So that's my house over there. And I would drive to work, you know, past a dairy farm, three dairy farms, which, you know, during the summer in Phoenix is not, I mean, they're right next to the road. It's not awesome, right? Other things that sucked during the summer in Phoenix, being pregnant, which I eventually was at one point. That was the summer of 2002, and suddenly my daily habits sort of changed, right? So they opened a Krispy Kreme right across the street, and every day, like, they have these raspberry-filled glazed donuts, which are, you know, magical. I can't even eat, like, a quarter of one now without wanting to explode, but... every day I would have, three of those things for breakfast with a giant jug of milk, presumably procured from the cows at the dairy farm. And then at lunch, you know, every day I started having a daily date with my friend Jack of Jack in the Box. I would have a bacon ultimate cheeseburger, and tacos. That's a lot of food. Just two, not three. You know, I wasn't having triplets or twins. You know, they're two for 99 cents. That's a nice round number. But I would go to lunch, and I would sit there, right? And I would just sort of unplug, because it's summer. It's hot. I'm 8 months pregnant. I just want to breathe, and I've got a bunch of work going on, and I just sort of needed to chill. So I would just... But you see, the reason that I needed to chill was I had this coworker, right? And she was sort of, well, we'll call her a super achiever. She wasn't even an overachiever. She was a super achiever. She was I double majored in electrical and computer science engineering at MIT and did that in 4 years, right? Perfect Intel specimen for hiring, right? She's got multiple degrees. She's highly motivated. She apparently doesn't ever need to sleep and probably has clones at her house. Weekends are a myth. Everything is a fire drill, right? Like, someone on high wants something that they're probably not even going to want in 15 minutes. They're going to forget about it. Well, that was cause for us to drop everything and run around in circles with our, you know, like, our heads are cut off. And work, you know, work all the time. Working late, working weekends, calling me at random hours of the night, you know. So I would go to lunch, and I would kind of come back from lunch, and I'd be like, huh, I'm refreshed. I'm ready to, you know, tack the rest of the day and put up with this crap. I could gather my thoughts in private without being interrupted by people who would ignore the sign hanging in front of my cubicle saying, I'm working, please don't interrupt me. And they'd be like, hey, do you mind if I interrupt you? No, not at all. But I felt better, right? And it wasn't just the 5,000 calories that I just stuck in my stomach that was making me feel better. But after I thought about it for a while, you know, this whole going to lunch and sort of just unplugging was really kind of normal to me, right? Like, I'd had other jobs before Intel. You know, I was a sysadmin. I'm still recovering from that. I was a market research analyst. I wrote really boring reports. And I used to actually take lunches, right? I'd get in my car and I would drive away from work. And then I would come back later and be, you know, ready to go. You know, I am a person who covets a little bit of quiet and silence time. So one day, coworker, who I, you know, just adored in spite of her maniacal nature, she looks like she's about to just keel over, right? And I'm like, dude, what's up? And she's like, I'm hungry. I haven't had any time to eat. I'm not going to have any time to eat today. I've got all this stuff going on. I haven't slept. And I'm like, dude, go eat. Just, like, seriously, that you can go eat. This stuff will be fine. Like, it's not a big deal. Just go eat. Like, in fact, go take a two-hour lunch. Just go do it. And she was like, yeah, you do this every day, don't you? I'm like, yeah, I do this. And you see, I'm not a basket case, so maybe you should think about that, too. So she goes and she takes a two-hour lunch, right? First time ever. She's never even left campus, really, for lunch because, you know, they have a cafeteria there so that you don't have to leave. You can just eat at your desk, right? Work-life balance, that's what they're working for there. And she was so stunned when she came back because she was like, wow, I'm refreshed and ready to attack the rest of the day. I'm like, yeah, that's what I do, and that's why I'm, yeah. Good job, right? So then she started doing this every day. Like, it was great. And then 2 weeks later, she was like, I'm taking a week of PTO. I was like, oh, why is that? She's like, well, you know, I've been relaxing so much. I think it would really be in my best interest to, you know, relax even more. I, you know, I feel like I've sort of lost my way. And I was like, okay, well, that's cool. You know, I'll be glad when you get back. And then it turned into a month of PTO, and then later she just never came back. And which made me sort of feel bad. Like, did I don't know. But, you know, I sort of asked around, and I was like, is this, have you guys said, oh, yeah, this sort of happens here at Intel. You know, like, it's burnout. You know, you see that kind of thing here all the time. And I was sort of like, and that's acceptable? This is kosher? Like, this happens all the time and we just accept it. Like, how, you know, why are we saying that this is okay? So, I sort of like to think of myself as an armchair psychiatrist. You guys have all heard of the term armchair quarterback, right? That's the person who watches football at home and knows exactly what should be going on but couldn't ever actually play football. So I'm the armchair psychiatrist. Since that point in time, you know, when I worked at Intel, I've seen a lot of things. Most of it, you know, lots of good things in my life. I've also seen some very, you know, traumatic stuff go on in the people, you know, that I know and that I love. Lots of mental health issues that I've seen. I happen to find the brain to be very, you know, a fascinating little thing inside our heads. I think it's interesting, you know, how it, you know, can screw up, get chemically imbalanced, you know, how it, you know, tends to heal itself in certain situations, you know, just how it's generally wired. I have read countless psychiatry articles. I've read all sorts of stuff on medication management and psychiatric drugs, like, you name it, I'm happy to sit down and have a conversation about that stuff with you. When people that you know and love have, you know, head issues, you tend to learn a lot, even though sometimes you feel, like, completely helpless, right? Because you're not a psychiatrist, there aren't all the answers, science hasn't found the answers. But the one thing that I've started to, you know, at least I can maybe correct other people's perceptions about mental health, right? You know, I have had arguments with people about, you know, is there a difference between a psychopath and a sociopath? Yes! Like, you know, don't just label people like that. You know what you're actually saying when you're doing that? You're saying someone has narcissistic personality disorder. Oh, really? Are you sure? Have you ever read what, you know, constitutes that? I've explained to people that being an asshole and having Asperger's are not exactly one and the same, and that, you know, Asperger's isn't even really classified as a syndrome anymore in the newest version of the DSM, right? There's a new version out. Now it's just part of the autism spectrum. It's not even a separate diagnosis, right? Because I have actually read the DSM for fun, and it's like this thick. So I'm a little weird. What can I say? Anyway, so, you know, even though I'm still unable to do things, you know, to help people sometimes. I do get things out of this, right? So for one thing, I find that understanding at least some of this stuff helps me to understand how to better deal with certain people in a community, or really anybody in a community, right? It helps me figure out how to be productive rather than counterproductive and murderous with those people. Because, you know, really, let's face it, there are a lot of different kinds of personalities in open source, right? We've all been on mailing lists, we've all been in forums, we've been on IRC. Oh boy, you know, it's a wild world out there, right? Especially when you never have to see anybody face to face, you tend to hide behind your internet persona sometimes. But a lot of people make sweeping broad generalizations about, you know, some of these personalities, right? Like, how many times have you heard someone say, like, oh my god, they're, like, completely bipolar? But they probably just had a bad morning, right? Like, yeah, so they blew up. That does not, you know, constitute a diagnosis, right? Or, you know, they're an asshole because, you know, they're a psychopath. No, not really. Or, you know, that guy's always so weird and awkward. It's probably like Asperger's. And, you know, and people throw these terms around without realizing the weight and gravity of what those actual diagnoses are, you know, and how it affects people. And, you know, without really thinking about, you know, there are ways to work with those people. And, you know, there are people out there who are actually afflicted with those issues, and, you know, while there's a pill to help out with a lot of things, sometimes people are having a bad day, and sometimes people are just assholes. And there's not really any need to mix up people who have genuine issues with people who are just assholes. And some of those genuine issues can actually, you know, be really, really debilitating, right? Some aren't preventable, some are hereditary. Some, you know, have success with medication in some people, and other people take the same medication and get absolutely nothing from it, and, you know, it's the pill to cure them, and, you know, it doesn't work. For some people, there are warning signs, right? For other people, there are no signs. There's no obvious cause. It's nothing that they did. It's nothing that they did to themselves, or nothing that their parents did to them. And sometimes the only thing you can do for some of these people is make sure that they have a safe environment where they can't hurt themselves or hurt others. But for other issues, there are often signs, ways to intervene, and, you know, we always try to hope and help people get treatment for that. You know, we talk about depression and burnout, you know, I think more often than we used to here in open source land, right? I think we're starting to break the barrier of mental health issues are a stigma, and these are sort of the first two that we've all, you know, really started to talk about. And we're talking about them fairly openly, you know, without a lot of judgment, which is a good thing. So, I say this cautiously, the we who are talking about these things tend to be people who deeply care about their communities or people who have experienced it themselves, right? People I talked about at the beginning, the people who want to make the world a better place, people who want to make their community a better place, not just for the sake of the community's ability to make the world a better place, but because they actually care about those individuals in their community. So we do a lot of this whole, you know, watch for warning signs in your friends. Are your friends gaining weight or losing weight? You know, are they crying uncontrollably at random, you know, intersections? Are their sleep habits messed up? You know, are they not eating well? Can you see any of this over the internet? No, usually not, right? So a lot of times we don't see any of this, you know. We think people might be stressed out, but we don't get to see, you know, maybe the things that people at their homes are seeing. Don't get me wrong, though. If you do see warning signs, you know, talk with those people. Try to not be a cure evangelist. I don't know if you guys have heard that term. That's when you go and say, hey, oh, so you're depressed. You know, my Aunt Sally was depressed, and she went and took a tightrope walking class, and it really taught her to, like, blah, blah, blah. And you should totally do that because, you know, some of these people have, like, you know, they're struggling with these issues. They've probably gone and read everything there is to read about it and, you know, are probably very frustrated that they're not getting better. So, you know, when people come to them and assume, like, oh, you don't know anything about what's wrong with you, but, you know, go take a tightrope walking class, it's sort of like, you know, it drags on you. You know, a lot of times it's chemical imbalance. You don't just, you know, snap out of it, you know, even with a tightrope walking class. In any case, but, you know, a lot of us do watch for all of these signs, you know, especially if, you know, like me, you've seen the signs before, you go, wow, that person, she really reminds me of that girl I work with at Intel, and she is just walking right into the dragon's mouth here, like, you know, maybe I should, you know, warn her, give her some perspective, you know, just check in, make sure she's not completely overwhelmed with things. You know, seeing bad things come to fruition once is bad enough. Seeing it happen again, you start to feel sort of bad. So I think a lot of us tend to be very, very vigilant. We do care about other people in our communities. We want to make sure that people are healthy and good. But, you know, holy crap, we all tend to do a pretty failed job, at least I do anyways, of watching ourselves for those same exact signs, right? Like, I'm always happy to, you know, ask other people, like, are you feeling overwhelmed? You know, you've got a lot on your plate. Do I ever ask myself that? No, not really. So, so a few months ago, I had a lovely friend of mine named Seth Vidal die after he got hit by a jerk on his bicycle. It was sad. It's still very sad. Insert lots of four-letter words here. Death is hard. It's hard on communities. It's even worse when people are sort of young, when it's unexpected, it's not their time, and it is news that really just sucks to deliver, right? There is no manual for this. It's just, you know, you go with your heart, you hope that what you're saying is right and that everything is, you know, that everyone's going to somehow magically pull together. So while I'm delivering all of this news, you know, to sound clinical about it, you know, giving it formally to people in the form of mails and that kind of stuff, I found myself, like, completely inundated with requests for, like, how can I help? And do you know what's going on with this? And do you know what's going on with that? Which would all turn eventually into conversations of, you know, sort of sadness where I was listening to people and, you know, letting them use my shoulder to cry on. And that was totally fine. Like, you know, these are people I love to, you know, it was very much a time of bonding. I talked to one of my friends named Justin, who's one of my smoking track buddies at every Fedora event that there ever was, and he asked me, he said, well, how are you doing? And I said, well, you know, I'm okay, you know, I'm alive, and that's better than other people, which sucks, so, you know, I'm okay, that's about all I can say. And he said, well, yeah, but you are listening to everybody, but who's listening to you? You can't just absorb and absorb and absorb, right? Like, even a sponge has its, you know, limits where the water is just not going to soak in anymore. And, you know, it's not just this. I mean, we still have the rest of everything else in Fedora that's going on, and you're trying to take care of everyone else. But at some point, are you taking care of yourself? Because if you're not, you're not going to be able to take care of anything. And that sort of got me to thinking. I was like, am I taking care of myself? Am I telling everyone in the universe that everything is going to be okay, even though I am completely falling apart inside? So, I guess back to my crazy job then, right? So, I actually have two jobs, right? Number one is the Fedora project leader. Number two is mom, right? Mom is definitely a full-time job. Being a parent is a full-time job, so basically I have two full-time jobs. So I'm looking at the state of my life, and I'm thinking, you know, back then, back in July, and I'm going, huh, wow, okay, like, so here's what I found, right? So I have a bank of PTO time, right? Like, you know, I accrue it at my job, and I hadn't taken any, like, I, you know, in a year plus, except the forced Christmas vacation during which I worked the previous year, and it was just falling off that, right? Like, I'm basically just, like, giving money away in some sort of sense. I have unfinished projects all over my house. You know, like, I bought this picture frame at Target, and I'm going to put that picture in it someday, right? I'm going to cut out my kids' school pictures and hang them on the wall next year. My kids were getting ready to go back to school, like, okay, I gotta get their school supplies and stuff. Yeah, I can do that tomorrow. People at Outback Steakhouse, my local Chinese restaurant, the local Indian restaurant, and the local Thai restaurant, they all know my name and exactly what I'm ordering. Like, they see my phone number and they pick up and they go, hey, Robin, the usual. And I'm like, yeah, I hadn't cooked a meal. I don't even remember the last time I cooked a meal. Like, we would go out or we would bring in, and that's about it. And I used to cook a lot. Like, I enjoy cooking. I burn things a lot, but, you know, I cook. All of my, you know, sort of social side interest, you know, mailing lists that I was subscribed to, hadn't read them for months. Like, my Google inbox was almost full, and I think they give you, like, 45 petabytes anymore. And so, you know, that, when that's almost full, you're like, I'm not really reading anything or, you know, archiving red mails because I'm not even getting to that, you know, part of my day that I used to have. The friends that, you know, lived by me, hadn't seen them in ages. Had one of my best friends move back to town after going off to doctor school forever. I've seen her twice in, like, 6 months when we used to hang out constantly. My Christmas tree, it's July, still standing up. Okay? It's July. It's Christmas in my house. You know, this is not fun. Basically, I was working. I'd get on a plane, I'd work some more, I'd come home. I refer to it as the daily configuration, management, and deployment of my children to their educations. You know, getting them dressed, sending them off to school, helping with their homework, just, you know, the process every morning. I wish I could press a button, but, you know, it's more like, get up. Okay, let's get dressed. You know, that whole process. And then homework, and then dinner, and bed. But, you know, all of these things used to be fun to me. Like, but it wasn't, you know, a lot of it wasn't being as much fun anymore. I wasn't being as productive. And, you know, even though I've always been sort of cynical, those of you who know me, you know, sort of cynical, right? Like, boy, I had grown to a whole new level of cynicism. And that's when I realized, like, that I'm the one on the train wreck course for burning out and not watching out, you know, like, I'm watching out for everybody else and I'm not watching out for myself. I want to do my job well, you know, in my role, and I can't really actually do that well if I'm in some sort of weird combo state of burnout and depression. So, FYI, I'm not a doctor, nurse, therapist, psychiatrist, psychologist, lawyer, tax attorney, or an expert in anything, really. I don't even have a degree. So I will caution and say this. What I'm about to say is not cure evangelism. I'm not any of these things. I'm not in the healthcare industry. I'm not trying to tell you that if you do what I do, that, you know, and you're burned out or depressed, that these things will help you. Okay, this is me attempting to just share with you things about me that I'm trying to do for myself so that I can just try and have a little bit more balance in my life, because I found myself on the teetering edge of, oh my God, if I just go one step further, I'm going to fall into this black hole, and that is not a place where I need to be. And I'm just telling you this, you know, because, hey, it's a keynote, and I gotta share something useful and poignant, right? But I'm trying to be more balanced in my life, mostly because I want to avoid going down the same paths that I've seen so many other people go down. So, helium hand. Helium hand is a term I recently learned. This is actually a water-filled balloon hand, but I cannot find any Creative Commons licensed pictures of floating hands. So, it's sort of like what a floating hand would look like, right? But it's helium hand is a term that is, I find to be hilarious and very apropos of what it describes, right? It's this urge we have to, like, stick up our hand whenever something needs to be done, right? Like, oh, I can totally do that, right? I'll just, no, it's no big deal. I can do it. Pops right up like a balloon filled with helium, almost uncontrollably. So I'm trying to learn how to say no. Like, no, I just can't do that, right? I need to top off my helium hand at the wrist. Just say no, you know, not to drugs, but, you know, to volunteering for everything. I need to stop doing that and getting pulled into every single little thing, no matter how passionate I am about it. Because really, life will go on, right? If something falls on the floor, things are really going to be okay. And really, you know, if you are in any sort of community, sometimes the result can actually be that your community becomes more resilient, right? You shouldn't have single points of failure where if one thing, you know, doesn't get done, or one thing goes wrong, or only one person can possibly do it, you know, that's a point of failure that, you know, can bring everything crashing down. So sometimes that's the impetus for figuring out how to make that process actually function better. Is every little thing in an open source community actually absolutely essential? Not necessarily. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out, you know, how can I say no, or how can I help solve the problem of that actually being a single point of failure? This has been hard for me, right? Like, I don't like disappointing people. Like, it makes me feel sort of bad and guilty. But I've had to realize that, you know, small disappointments here and there are better than giant flaming explosions of, you know, things going very, very, very wrong. I'm also trying to find the little joys in life. Who plays Minecraft? So few people. Okay, so one night, a couple months ago, my daughter comes in. She's 11 now, but she was 10 at the time. She came in. You know, I was actually cooking dinner. A momentous occasion, right? Making stew. And she's like, hey, I filed this bug report in Minecraft. I'm sorry, you did what? And she's like, well, you know, I was playing on the snapshot. I'm like, wow, you've got fancy. I'm like, so tell me what a snapshot is. She's like, well, you know, it's like the version that's not out, but it's what's going to be coming out. I was like, okay, so she knows what she's talking about. Okay, this is sort of crazy. And she explains to me, you know, they're bringing horses in into the next, you know, version, and she's on her horse, and, you know, all this stuff goes on. I said, okay, well, show me this bug report of yours, right? So, you know, I go in her room, and this is what she has here, right? Like, a description. She has what I expected, what actually happened. She wrote down steps to reproduce. Okay, this is better than, like, 99% of the bugs that any open source project actually gets, and my daughter is 10. She's not telling me that she's not telling them that it sucks or that it's horrible or crappy. She's just telling just the facts, ma'am. That's all she's giving them. And I'm not kidding you. Like, this may have been, like, my second most proud moment as a parent ever, right after you learned how to use the toilet. I mean, this was like, oh, honey, I love you. I'm just so excited for you. And yes, that stuff where you want to go to MineCon. Yes, I'm taking her to MineCon because I have to put all of those frequent flyer miles to use. We're taking the whole family to MineCon, and the look on her face when she found out that this ticket sold out in 10 seconds and came in so crestfallen that she wasn't going to get to go, and I got to say, well, your mom's a badass. She got the tickets. That was glorious. So, small things, these little things in life that just happen sometimes can make you very happy, and sharing them with others, like with you guys, makes me very happy as well, and it, you know, kind of gives you the glow to gloss over all of the other bits of, you know, pain that you may have in your day. Books. I used to love reading. I was a voracious reader when I was a kid, and I've actually started reading again, like, a lot. Like, this is what I've read this year, a small portion of it, right? I like telling people about what I've been reading, so I've actually written at least one blog about it. I convinced my CEO, Jim Whitehurst, who is an awesome guy, to actually read The Phoenix Project. I sent him a mail. I expected it to go into a black hole, and like 2 months later, he's like, I got your mail. It was very passionate. Right? Red Hat's a like 5,000-6,000 person company these days. He wrote me back. He was like, your mail was so filled with passion, but before I wrote you back, I wanted to go read the book first, so I read it, and now I'm writing you back. And I was like, this is so awesome, you actually care, and he liked it, and he thinks it's fabulous, and it, hooray me, like, this, you know, another point of happy, like, I'm doing stuff that's not always at the center of my job, but sort of applying it back to my job, and yay, this is good, right? Good stuff in my life, right? Just trying to see it more. So, life is complicated, right? We all have a lot coming at us. Sometimes it seems like it is just so unbearably tangled up that we can't undo it all. So one of the other things that I'm trying to do for myself is figure out where I'm being inefficient, right? Like where I'm putting in way more effort than I should, doing stupid things, basically trying to figure out where are my productivity pipelines just backing up, and how can I fix that problem at the source rather than continuing to do the same complicated, stupid thing over and over, right? Because ultimately that frees up a little more free time for me. It means I can get back to taking, you know, a 2-hour lunch here once in a while. You know, ultimately for myself, I'm just trying to find balance in my life or create it where I can. I'm hoping that I'm getting better at figuring out what actually matters and what doesn't really matter. So things that matter, right? Like actually going to the dentist instead of putting it off for months and months and months. Having friends outside the community in which I contribute so that I can talk about other things in the universe or not constantly think about the same things all the time. Spending time with my family that I have, that I know, that I love me back in spite of, you know, my being human. Things that don't matter, right? Having a perfect record of contribution, doing something, you know, amazing and awesome and inspiring the world every day. Missing a meeting here and there. Not going to kill me, right? And, you know, balance, you know, can be in lots of places, right? My Christmas tree, still standing today. And frankly, at this point, it's almost Christmas again. So I figure at this point, I'm not going to have to set aside a bunch of hours standing the thing up again, you know, come November or December. So, beginning of my talk, I had a slide on the screen with the title of my talk. Some of you guys may have recognized the words in the title slide as being from a poem called If by Rudyard Kipling. And it starts off like this. Wow, except that I copy-pasted that twice. Well, that was totally fail. If you can keep your head about you when if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. Right? The poem sort of goes back and forth describing situations and how to react and deal with them in like a gentlemanly, distinguished way. And it's a long poem, like not, you know, it's not hugely long, but several stanzas, so I'm not even going to try and get into it. But the part that I found to be, you know, poignant, because it sort of points directly at the phenomenon of what's going on here, is this part. You can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they're gone, and still hold on when there is nothing in you except the will, which says to them, hold on. It's very much about, you know, if you could just keep going and persevering, and, you know, then you'll be awesome, right? And at the end of it, it's, you know, it says, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. And it's, hello. It's sort of, it's interesting because it basically is saying, like, push yourself way past the limit, and then you'll be a man, right? Which is sort of like, you know, yeah, that's really inspiring, and, you know, I can do it. And, you know, for a while, I actually thought about this whole poem as being like, well, this is really about open source contribution, right? Because it goes on about, like, you know, when you're getting in fights and people are twisting your words around, like, on a mailing list, and, you know, all these things that very much parallel things that happen to us in open source. But what it sort of represents to me now is, like, this is an impossibility, right? Like, this is insanity. You know, you can do all of these things, sure, but you can't really do that indefinitely, and you shouldn't want to do that stuff indefinitely. So, for those of you, you know, to all of us that strive to be that perfect, balanced, you know, awesome and amazing person every day that takes things on, who give other people comfort, you know, who are a shoulder to cry on, that, you know, want to help everything and make the world a better place, you know what, if you can't, that's okay, because you're human. And it's far more important for you to have you guys around for the long haul than to have just one more little thing done, right? Yes, this is a big world. Yes, we all want to make it better. But we all need to have each and every one of us there to actually do that. So that is my ponderings on don't overdo yourself. Try to not burn out. But if you do, you know, you're human and that's okay. Because we love you anyways. And we want to get you back to where you started and back to being healthy. So that is it.